Accession number 27083, reel 26.
So Henry, you said that some cruel wit in the crowd called out.
Yes, he called out, "What price the cruel thee now, Garth?" Because the first sea lord's horse, to his acute discomfort, because he wasn't a very good horseman, started to sort of jog sideways, and he was totally out of control. And the crowd saw this. So it had its funny moments, despite the weather. And then I think the only other thing I would comment on was the one really enjoyable moment of the entire day was taking the, I think it was three flights of stairs up to our headquarters in the gunnery division in the old Admiralty after it was all over, to listen to reports which were due to come in and did, as to whether there'd been any problems and anything had gone seriously wrong and so forth. And I was able to take those stairs, three stairs at a time, and you stretched your legs. And it was almost indecent, it was almost obscene, the bliss that just being able to stretch like that was. And the final thing was, I mentioned earlier that I had put on a brand new uniform suit for the occasion. And my next appointment, which I'll come on to shortly, was to a cruiser in the Far East. And I had been busy ensuring that the upper deck was squared off before Sunday divisions, church parade and so forth. And it fell to me, because I didn't have a division of my own, and I fell in with the unattached officers, fortunately, as it turned out. And I cut it rather fine, and I went to my cabin to put on my best uniform before divisions. And I hadn't worn it since Coronation Day. And I put it on, and even if I exhaled, I could barely do the buttons up. And the cuffs came about halfway down my forearm. So I stood in agony, fortunately with the unattached officers, and not in front of the fine body of men, my division, because I didn't have one. But history was made, because for the first time I was granted compensation for this. And the going rate for a uniform then was, give or take, 40 quid. Now it's about 400. And I got £2 in compensation. And that really completes my naval coronation activities. I was then appointed to the cruiser Birmingham, and 3 weeks later that appointment was changed, it was switched to the cruiser Newcastle. Both of the same class, town class, both very fine ships, and the only two which had been extensively modernized. And I'll talk about that later when I talk about Newcastle.
Well, so Henry, this, I think, might be a good point to pause until our next visit, my next visit. So shall we leave it there?
Right.
And now, Sir Henry, we're starting our third session of interviews, and I think that just before we move on to the Newcastle, which is where we left off at the end of our previous conversation, I think that you have a short recap that you'd like to recount, a short story possibly, or something you'd like to recount before we move on to the Newcastle.
Well, thank you. Yes, there was something that I forgot to mention earlier on. But throughout the whole of my task at the Admiralty, organising the Navy's part for the coronation and so forth, I was pretty certain that I would be given a sea job at the end of it. And the problem of my teeth, very domestic, but the problem of my teeth reared its head. I've always had, ever since I was a kid, I've always had very poor teeth. And whenever I visited a dentist, he always clucked and told me to come back twice, probably, and all that stuff. To the extent that, at the start of 1953 or so, I had by then had half my teeth out, and I was left like a rabbit, six up and six down in front, and the rest were ordinary gnashes. And one of those in front, which is not much fun in terms of having toothache, went sour on me. And the Admiralty had an admirable arrangement, because there were very few dentists in the Navy at the time. There weren't enough, really. And those that there were weren't terribly good dentists. They were all right with a hammer and a set of pliers, but it wasn't very refined. And the Admiralty's arrangement was that they provided a list of frightfully upmarket dentists in Harley or Wimpole Street, and you could look down the list and pick the chap with the most letters after his name, make a date, go and have your job done, and the Admiralty would pay. And this was quite convenient, of course, if you were stationed in London, and it applied for this, the Admiralty. So I duly did this, and I went along to this total stranger and told him my problem and said, one's gone sour, and I'm about to go to sea, and it'll be much worse there, of course, where there are no facilities for dealing with such things. So I've now decided that the moment has come, because one after another they're bound to go sour on me again, and I can't have a refurbishment, as it were, every time one goes sour, which is what it would involve if it had to come out. So I want the lot out. And he was a rather unpleasant man. He was short and fat and dour and didn't have a sense of humour and so forth, and said, this is absurd, you must leave an anchor, and all that tripe. And I said, no, I want the lot out. And he said, well, if you were to ask me to take the lot out, I would refuse. Right, I said, I'll go back to my old family dentist down in Bath, and I walked out of his room, and that was that. And to Bath I went, after prior arrangement, and had them all out, and that was it. And I told the splendid man down there, who lived in 20 of the Circus, and his father before him, brilliant dentists, and I said, now, I went into a nursing home for it, and said, now, when I come round, I expect to wake up with my new set of mousetraps, and that they would fit perfectly. And before I leave the nursing home, I want to be able to munch a ginger biscuit, which is quite hard stuff, as you know. Oh, he said, well, I don't know about that, but we'll see what we can do. He got them all out and fitted me with an admirable pair of set of snappers. And feeling a bit shaky, where I went back to London. And that was that. And I mentioned that because I can't describe how relieved I was, although I had one or two embarrassing moments over the years, which I won't bore you with, but the relief in knowing that you weren't dependent on some rather incompetent fellow to cure your toothache when you were in some far distant place in a ship. So, having, as I think I mentioned earlier, initially been appointed to the Birmingham, 3 weeks later that was changed to the Newcastle, both identical six-inch cruisers of the same town class, in my judgment, the finest-looking ships in the Navy. And
why would you say that?
Just by their lines. Everything was in the right proportion. Yes. The funnels had a rake.
The aesthetic appearance of the ship.
Yes.
Yes.
And those two particular ships, there were still one or two others around, but Birmingham and Newcastle had been fully modernized at virtually identically the same time, but in different dockyards.
May I just interrupt? Is Belfast a member of this class?
No. Belfast was a sister ship of the Edinburgh, sunk during the war.
Yes.
And she was slightly bigger, and had was not so good looking because they had the after funnel above the mainmast, and it didn't look right somehow. Now these were the creme de la creme in terms of good looks, just that.
And can you just describe, before we go on, can you just describe what their naval function is? One understands what a battleship does, a carrier and a destroyer. What does I assume a fast 6-inch gun cruiser do in 1953? What's its function?
In the height of peace, it is like virtually any other warship. It is a presence and exerting influence and that sort of thing. But you are there to provide all sorts of support if things come to, if they deteriorate, that you have to intervene and actually indulge in hostilities, as it were, which might range from bombardment, full title naval gunfire support, in terms of the army ashore, and so forth, in terms of evacuation, in terms of posing a threat and hence acting as a deterrent to the baddies when they got a bit over exuberant, and so forth. And therefore they were, being smaller, half the size or less of a battleship, you could afford to have more of them. They had smaller guns, shorter range, but you could deploy them on more of a worldwide basis. They were very valuable. So off I went to Singapore, and I took passage in a trooper with the Gloucesters, because Korea was still on. And they played an important part in the Korean War. And the only thing that really stands out in my memory about that passage, they were a very nice lot, the Gloucesters, from the colonel downwards. And a couple of... There was one major, I think, and a subaltern and myself. And I was a pretty young and pretty junior lieutenant commander. And to entertain everybody, we did a thing of Three Little Maids. Three Little Maids from School, the song, from Gilbert and Sullivan and so forth. And we did a skit on that, having dressed ourselves as Three Little Maids. And that went down quite big.
Well, you'd had some practice having dressed up as a nurse. I think
I'd had some practice at Whale Island in amateur dramatics, but not very much, and it wasn't my forte really. But so, well, we got to Singapore without incident, and the Newcastle was in refit, in up at the naval base, of course, and I ought perhaps at this stage to point out the extent of the modernization of these two ships, Birmingham and Newcastle. Birmingham was also out in the station. They had both pretty well come to the end of their first commission since modernization. And the modernization had consisted of principally the following. The fire control system for the secondary armament, which was 4-inch, of which they had 8 disposed in 2 twin mountings either side amidships, and the elderly fire control system, which was almost calculated that you missed the target, had been removed and been replaced by the first electric, so-called simple electric deflection calculator. And that was quite a tricky instrument, and it required a great deal of tuning. But if it was on tune, and if you got the thing absolutely right, you'd hit the target, as I'll come to a bit later on. They enclosed the compass platform, so you had an enclosed bridge, which was one of the early ones, really, but the penny had dropped by then that an open bridge was a hostage to fortune in bad weather. They had installed modern radar, and the secondary armament directors, one either side of the bridge, a little bit further aft, had the latest gunnery, fire control, radar, and so forth. They also installed air conditioning, and that was not for the benefit of the sailors. It wasn't for habitability reasons. It was entirely for to keep the temperature down with the equipment. And therefore, the coverage of the air conditioning was, put broadly, in the bridge superstructure, which is where the radar tubes and the most of the radar offices were situated. I will return to that a little later on. The captain to whom I was introduced about my first or second day was one called Bungie Rutherford. He was a gunnery officer. He was a funny little Humpty Dumpty of a man. He was supposed to be clever, but he certainly was very humorless. He had little affinity with people. His human contact was poor. And during my initial call, I can't remember what he said, but it didn't amount to rare beans. And he sat sort of slumped in his chair, and I wasn't at all impressed, because he didn't say what stage the ship had reached in the refit. He didn't say what he expected of me. He didn't really say anything of relevance. And
you, of course, are a lieutenant commander of medium
seniority. Very little seniority, junior. Sort of 1-2 years,
right.
That sort of thing. Well, my second day, by this time I'd taken over from my predecessor, and the ship being in refit, they were working tropical routine, which meant that you turned to early, worked until 1 o'clock, and apart from the fire party or whatever, did not return on board in the afternoon. And when I say they turned to early, of course, everybody was living ashore in what, I can't remember whether it was called such at the time, but eventually it was known as HMS Terror. It was effectively the naval barracks ashore at the naval base in Singapore. And every day we went to divisions, that is, the entire ship's company falling in, at 6:30 in the morning when it was pitch dark. And the first one I attended, because I normally went to divisions and that sort of thing, being the gunnery officer, I happened to pass the captain. And so I tore him off a salute. And you could only just sort of see that he was the captain, because it was pitch dark. And he said, good morning, guns, what do you think of all this? And without thinking, I said, not much, sir, and moved on. We never spoke again, and 3 weeks later he left the ship. And I can't honestly say that I was exactly devastated at his departure. I then discovered that, and I come back now to the air conditioning, I discovered that Bungie Rutherford had ordained that the air conditioning was to be set so that he could leave his sea cabin, which was close to the bridge, and spend half an hour on the bridge, now enclosed, in his pajamas without discomfort. This was the very early days of air conditioning. And as a result of that, if you were up off Korea, where in the winter months it was bitterly cold, bitterly. The temperature on the compass platform was about 75. So Bunjie could stay there for half an hour in his pyjamas. But in the places that mattered, the operations room, the gun direction room, the air direction room, it was sweltering, absolutely sweltering. And anybody keeping watch there would literally strip to the buff. They'd have nothing above the waist on, and they'd be sweating streams. And then, of course, from time to time, they'd be called out onto the freezing forecastle and all that sort of thing. Wasn't very clever. And the obverse occurred. Down at Singapore, where we were all in tropical rig, 3 degrees north of the equator and pretty cozy, and the ambient temperature ran at about 80 to 85. And there, on the compass platform, the temperature was 75, 80, fine. But the temperature in the operations room, in the gun direction room, in the air direction room, was freezing. And you were supposed to, the normal rig of the day was tropical rig, shirt and shorts. And many a time have I done time in the gun direction room there, or the operations room, in tropical rig, with a greatcoat on, and shivered with cold. So the air conditioning was, as I say, rather in its early days. Well, going on, the commander was a curious man called Barry Anderson. Later, to achieve considerable fame during the Cod War with Iceland, where, by which time I think he was a commodore. He, as did several others, but there wasn't an enormous number of them, he transferred to the Navy from the Merchant Navy at the beginning of the war. And in fact, he'd been quite a senior lieutenant in Mauritius, my first ship, where I was a midshipman, which I've told you about earlier on. The new captain was St. John Tirrett, a different kettle of fish altogether. He was short, dark, very professional, brilliant at ship handling, but, and I say this calculatedly, he was a Roman Catholic. And he was a devout one. And his home was in London, and he wrote to his Catholic bishop and asked for dispensation, because it had become the routine, and this was after the ship was out of refit and got going, it had become the routine, and a very good routine it was, that at 8 o'clock, which was the time that you hoisted the ensign in harbour and that sort of thing, and at 10 to 8 or so, a section of the ship's company, including the engine room department, if they were not actually on watch, and it wasn't half, it wasn't even a quarter, but it was a section of the ship's company, and most of the upper deck seamen went to divisions, and the chaplain said a few prayers, and we sang a hymn, and then it was colours, 8 o'clock, and then everybody except the seamen went about their business, and the seamen were told off the various tasks they had to do during the forenoon. And the captain thought this was an excellent idea, and he wanted to attend, and he was refused. He was refused dispensation by his bishop.
By his bishop.
I don't know who his bishop was. It doesn't matter. Whereupon he tortured himself with what's the best thing to do, and decided that he would actually not pay much attention to his bishop's lack of dispensation. So he always turned up for that. He was a very splendid man. Once we got going, we were the flagship of the second in command of the Far East, who at the time was Gerald Gladstone, later to be relieved by Robert Elkins. Very fine men, both of them. It was, as I think I mentioned earlier, it was the tail end of the Korean War. And put crudely, the patrols off the west coast of Korea were conducted by the Royal Navy, of which the station cruiser had assigned to her some small number of frigates and destroyers, and she was the senior officer, and ran the show west of the Korean Peninsula. And the east was dealt with by the United States Navy. It was a very good arrangement. And, of course, you transferred from time to time, but it was it worked very well. I mentioned earlier that the new and still largely untried anti-aircraft system for the secondary armament was quite tricky in terms of setting up and tuning and so forth. And I well recall that I established a routine that if we were going to do a shoot, I would get the second gunnery officer and myself shaken at 5:30 in the morning. We would probably sail at about 9 or so and open fire at 9:30, sort of thing. And we would go down to the calculating position, one each side, and we would tweak the system until we got the best answers we could contrive. And when we'd done so, we were, of course, in communication with each other. We'd swap over to check the other's work, and so forth. And many was the time when all the routine business, which was traditional and very sacrosanct almost, whereby the gunnery officer went up to the bridge when action stations were sounded or that bit of the armament was closed up and so forth, and received the reports from the various outposts that everybody was closed up, cleared away, and ready for action and so forth, and would ultimately report to the captain, ready to open fire or whatever. And many was the time when I got to the bridge with something like a minute to go, and probably the target-taking aircraft was already overhead. And report to the captain, ready for the practice, sir. And I would usually add, I think it might be all right, or I'm afraid it's going to be a waste of ammunition, depending on the degree of fine-tuning we had achieved during our morning watch. And this upset the captain rather. He took it very well, but he did took me to one side on one occasion, and he said, it's all very fine guns, but if this was wartime, what about then? And supposing who arrived on the bridge and said, it's going to be a waste of ammunition, and then we came under air attack. And I said, well, sir, you have to remember that there are a number of occasions when I don't say that, when I say I think it's going to be all right, and as you'll see, because he loved to see the target falling out of the sky. And under the old system, it was an absolute miracle. Unless the target was coming straight towards you, you really didn't stand a chance. It was a complete fluke if you knocked it down. Now, at least, you stand a chance if it's tweaking. And there's no doubt that one would be tweaking it just about every watch and so forth. I don't think I convinced him entirely, but he did love to see the sleeve tumbling out of the sky.
Why did the system go offline? What?
It was a sort of foible of the electrics, electric rather than electronic, and it drifted. And if it drifted too far, and everything interacted, all the computery interacted. So if you've got one element, shall I say, that was spot on, to get it spot on, you might put another element or elements in the plural
out.
Mm-hmm. And the whole thing, therefore, was a compromise,
and you had to get the best compromise you could, and sometimes it was a very good compromise. And if it was a good compromise, then you shot the sleeve down. And because the Korean War was on, I, at the first opportunity, when we, which was immediately after the refit, I refused to embark practice ammunition for the anti-aircraft armament. So it was all live stuff. And with practice ammunition, you get a tiny puff of smoke, if it is sufficiently close to the sleeve target, known as a target-triggered burst. But unless you actually physically hit the towing wire, you won't knock the sleeve down. With service ammunition, proper high-explosive ammunition, of course, your chances of severing the wire were enormously increased, enormously. And if you had a target-triggered burst, down came the sleeve, which was very good for morale. But it upset the naval armament stores officer, who said I was running his supplies too short. But I got away with that. Well, now, going on, when I took over, I wasn't, after my first couple of shoots or so, I wasn't terribly happy about the accuracy.
Excuse me.